I studied with as extremes as I could. So my very first shows were on one hand Ghost, which was very quirky, fun, kind of crazy, high energy shows with supermodels laughing and having fun and drinking and whatever. At the exact same time, I started doing the shows for Mucha Prada, which were very androgynous in a way, very minimal, very military, I don't want to say dry, because we managed to create an emotion. But I mean, it was the start of Prada, as you can imagine, 20 some years ago, and of Miu Miu. And it was the same girls, you know, it's still you're still with the same models and the supermodels. But they were very straight, not moving hips. You know, 1 hour on a Prada runway and then completely giggly the hour after on a Ghost runway. And I was doing both. That was, I think, what started charming me the most about doing fashion shows is the fact that I realized I could, within the same exercise, apply completely different points of view and different directions to the same people in front of the same people.
Alexandre de Batac is the king of runway shows. Over the past 30 years, he has produced more than 1,000 catwalk extravaganzas for fashion giants including Dior, Prada, and Calvin Klein. He has built a mountain of 300,000 blue flowers in the courtyard of the Louvre for Dior, turned a Chinatown market into a runway for Raf Simons, and created a spinning stage for Hussein Chalayan. In 2000, his live-streamed show for Victoria's Secret broke the internet. A native Parisian, his first love was photography. After moving into producing fashion shows, he launched his agency Bureau Batac in Paris in 1990, aged just 22. Keen to escape Paris's deep-seated traditions, he moved to New York in 1994. It was the age of the supermodels, New York Fashion Week was in its infancy, and the industry was open to new ideas. And de Batac had these in abundance. He changed the way people thought about runway shows and what they could achieve, with his architectural sets but also his choreography, sending models down the runway laughing, drinking champagne, or walking in groups or at different paces. Today, de Batac, who has been dubbed the Fellini of fashion, splits his time between New York and Paris. He has just released a book titled De Batac Fashion Show Revolution, which commemorates his 1,000th show milestone and is filled with tidbits of information and backstage footage. It comes at a time when the industry and its traditional runway format is in a state of flux, thanks to the rise of social media. Now, shows are watched by millions of people on their phones or laptops, not just by the handful of editors sitting in the room. Needless to say, the producer and artistic director has big plans for the digital future, and I'm pleased to say that he joins me today in Paris. I wondered if we could go back to the very start. Have you always been interested in fashion?
Yes and no, actually not really, not at all. Fashion is more what happened to me following other interests. I started doing photography when I was very, very young, when I was literally a kid. I started taking pictures when I was 7. I started working when I was maybe 14. I was doing pictures for Berlitz travel guides, you know, the little Swiss guides. When I was 15, I think I did one in Chicago, then in Alaska on a cruise. And that led me to then starting shooting for magazines while I was in my last years of school, of high school, and to start meeting people, amongst which a fashion designer with whom I started working when I was still finishing my back, you know, my end of school in Paris. And that's how I discovered fashion.
I'm interested in that kind of going from shooting clothes, shooting for designers, to when you're now setting up this first show for Sibylla, you have to be thinking about what people are seeing the whole way through. Was that kind of a difficult thing, or does that require like a different way of thinking?
I mean, to be honest with you, if I thought of it today, I probably would answer yes. But back then, at the age I was completely spontaneous and as free-minded as one can imagine. But everyone was. I mean, first of all, the world was a little bit different. But aside from that, it's the age that was different. I mean, being a teenager, hopefully in every time and in any given time of history is always being a teenager. And that comes with complete freedom to a certain degree. And also the lack of experience comes with complete freedom, or brings you complete freedom, which is something I actually really enjoy having had and to a certain degree would recommend to a lot of people. You know, before you know anything, just based on your own culture and your curiosity, do as much as you can with that free-mindedness that you have before you know too much? So the answer is no. Back then, it wasn't hard, it wasn't different, just because I wasn't even thinking about it. You know, I was very young, presented with the opportunity to do a fashion show. A fashion show is you've got to show the clothes, put them on the real people, put them on the runway, show them to real people, have them be shot by cameras, by TVs and photographers. And all that can happen very spontaneously. What was fun, that of course it made our first shows very different than most others, because I was very amateur in a way. So, I mean, I remember my relationships with the models at the very beginning, giving them instructions on what to do. They were kind of laughing because I was A, younger than them, which is, I mean, unthinkable today, and B, completely improvising everything I was doing or telling them. And we were doing very storytelling fashion shows in a way, but we didn't know anything else or any other way to do it. To be younger than the girls back then, and we're talking the late 80s, well, yeah, very end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, was still the time of the supermodels. So not only was I younger than them, but they were bigger than life, you know. It was very impressive to be backstages doing, well, not so much for Sibylla, that now moved on. I mean, Sibylla, when she was very young, obviously, we didn't do supermodel shows yet. No, a few of them we convinced and loved what she did, and I convinced to come on board, like Helena Christensen, I remember, was doing our shows, and Rossi de Palma back then. And I mean, there was quite a few amazing characters. But very quickly, after that, I moved to New York and I started doing shows. And then one of my first shows was Prada.
What sparked that? Why move from Paris and all these kind of glamorous shows that were going on here to New York?
I think, there's a few reasons. I had the chance to early evolve and grow up in a fairly international world that Paris had at that time. I started taking pictures, I started working at a few different clients. I started very, very earlier. I opened up my first company, my first office when I right at the end of high school, and then Brobetac in 1990, actually. So it's been a while. So I was just fresh out of high school. Things went pretty well, though there's a couple of reasons. One is that when things go well, people tend to, well, back then more than even now, put you in a drawer. And especially here, France is Europe in general and France in even particular is an amazing country for the culture and history it has. But for that same reason, it moves very slowly. You get always everywhere the benefits of the, of the advantages and its opposite. So the advantages of strong, resistant culture is also that everything else resists. So things are slow. And the other thing is that the economy was really bad. It was, it was the Gulf War. I mean, the post-Gulf War recession in 91. Most Anglo-Saxons, Americans, everyone was, when economy is bad, there's not much left to do for the ones, for anyone. So they were all gone and I got bored. But America always gets back better faster out of economic troubles. Both England and France and most of Europe was really bad. And in fact, in the creative in general worlds and fashion worlds in particular, the English went first. I mean, New York was full of English people in important positions in magazines and in fashion in general. And I saw it as a both an opportunity and a need. It was the beginning of New York Fashion Week. It, in fact, started in 92 or 93, around there, which is when I went. Also, the trends were evolving quite fast. It was the start of minimalism and the start of grunge. And meanwhile, in New York, most fashion brands were still in the twirling 80s on the runway, like in Dallas and Dynasty, So I arrived there and I was like, wow, there's a lot to do here. There's a lot to bring. There's a lot to share. There's a lot we can hopefully communicate to designers and to a community that are not at all on the same page than I was. And I came with this weird mix of my upbringing in Paris and this general European culture with what I had been working into recently, which is a mix of the Sibylla Pre-Raphaelite type romantic things, but also influenced by, as I said, by the times I was growing up in Paris, which were mostly the start of the Japanese, the androgynous, all of that stuff, which hadn't yet arrived in America in a way. So for all of these reasons, I went without even knowing I went. I mean, I was going to New York a lot and then little by little I stayed. And I realized that I could do a lot there and that cliche of the American dream, where everyone can do anything, I have to say, is always true at the beginning. It's not that America is easier to succeed. It's easier to try and it's easier to start. But there is a more open mind for beginnings than there is in Europe. And again, for obvious reasons, it's a much more young culture. It doesn't have the deep roots that European countries have. And it frees their minds, or it frees people's minds in general a little more to be receptive for anyone starting anything.
So I'm interested in what the fashion world was like at that time, because it's obviously changed so much. And with social media and everything now, it's kind of become so much more open and transparent. Whereas back then, was it kind of quite an enclosed group where it was like the editors, you know, only a select few people actually seeing the shows? Did that mean it was harder to kind of get into?
When I started, or even before I started, when I looked at it, was yes, it was a closed group, but it was also a much less important business as a whole in general. So it was also a more free world in a way. Fashion shows were a very private affair, in fact. The media was hardly yet getting into sharing them. I mean, when I started, it was the beginning, I think, of TVs in, I mean, TV of course existed, but there weren't important shows on TV showing fashion shows. That all started when I started as well. I think those weekly shows where you see all Fashion Week and all this. Before that, fashion shows were private affair for long lead press, for editors and buyers, but that had to process that information and shoot it and print it, or even package it and edit it and show it much later. But also, as I just said, because the field was less important, less rich, the budgets were less important, there was more creative freedom in it, and there was more freeformness in it, and it was a less professional field, specifically the one in which I was, of making fashion shows. In fact, again, when I arrived in New York, I started with, not improvising so much anymore, because I'd done a few, but there was still a lot of spontaneity in the approach of everything I did and we did then with fashion shows. And the world of fashion itself in New York was so new. I mean, again, not so much the world of fashion, but the Fashion Week and the idea of Fashion Week was so new that it was open to all reinterpretations and to all sorts of novelties that I could bring spontaneously from whatever I thought would be right.
Do you remember the first show that you put on in New York?
The first fashion show that I put on in New York was for Ghost. I don't know if you remember Ghost. Tanya San was an English. She was the first foreign fashion designer to come to that new New York Fashion Week with a brand named Ghost. And those shows were known to be incredibly fun, with all supermodels would do it out of friendship for Tanya and out of love for the clothes and for us and whatever. But we're having a lot of fun. I do remember that I very early on decided, I don't know if so consciously, but probably, to try to choose, or to choose as much as I could, but to manage to get to do the most diverse shows I could right away. So I think I started with as extremes as I could, and I very quickly understood and believed and wanted to help brands and designers be as individually extremely different one from the other. So my very first shows were on one hand Ghost, which was very quirky, fun, kind of crazy, high energy shows with supermodels laughing and having fun and drinking and whatever. At the exact same time, I started doing the shows for Miuccia Prada, which were very androgynous in a way, very minimal, very military, I don't want to say dry, because we managed to create an emotion still, and dry wouldn't be moving. But I mean, it was the start of Prada, as you can imagine, 20-some years ago, and of Miu Miu. And it was the same girls. You know, it's still you're still with the same models and the supermodels. But they were very straight, not moving hips, you know, 1 hour on a Prada runway and then completely giggly the hour after on a Ghost runway. And I was doing both. That was, I think, what started charming me the most about doing fashion shows, is the fact that I realized I could, within the same exercise, apply completely different points of view and different directions to the same people in front of the same people.
And in terms of the kind of process of creating a show for a brand, Does a brand come to you and say, you obviously have long-standing relationships with all these brands, but will they come to you and say, this is our collection, this is the thinking behind it? Like, how specific will the instructions be for you, or do they kind of let you have free rein to an extent?
So from, I want to say from, to get a concrete example, you know, from, say, Dior, that I've been working with for almost 20 years now, it'll be 20 years next year, and at Dior with John Galliano first, for the first, I'm not sure how many, 15 almost, maybe years, then with Raf and now with Maria Grazia, it's been incredibly different with each one of them. John's inspirations were often at the beginning very historical, often very narrative, but always mixed and never literal. So John would give me those mixes. Some of them you can visualize historically, and others just conceptually or narrative-wise or literary-wise. I mean, it would be a mix of, say, okay, you know, it's a market sad inspired story, but which will take place in such and such country or whatever. That's always before the collection starts. I mean, one thing that I should say first to answer that, we always start working on the show before the collection has even started, by definition, because it takes a lot of time. So we finish at the very end, but we start even way before then. So when we discuss with the designer, they either tell us in words their inspirations. They show us, a lot of them do visual research, of course, with mood boards or beautiful inspiration notebooks like John Galliano used to have. We discuss this, we look at that, we listen to the inspirations and start thinking of how to enhance all this. But as I was saying earlier, all designers are different. So to enhance sometimes mean going in sync with the designer's inspirations, or to enhance for me often meant going reverse or going against. In fact, in the specific case of John Galliano, for example, I think John called me and we started working together in great understanding, but in great complementarity. We are very, very different culturally, and we both acknowledged that when we started. And we had this amazing, really close, intimate relationship of almost 15 years based on our differences and our complementarity of my understanding of his narrative and how I would propose to enhance those in a parallel kind of world and setup and setting. As in, after that, with Raf Simons, with whom I still work, and I have the chance to do amazing shows with at Dior and now at Calvin Klein and for his own brand at Raf, it's completely different. I don't want to say it's the opposite of John, because nothing is the opposite of anything, but it's drastically different. Raf is incredibly precise, knows exactly. It's not even that he knows exactly what he wants, because that would make him sound very square, and it's not true. He's extremely precise and also extremely open. He can start very precisely somewhere, and we can end up very precisely somewhere else.
And I'm interested in how much of this kind of tension between what you've spoken about as wanting to create a show that's memorable but also contributes to the brand's enduring identity. The tension between that and the fact that for these fashion brands, you know, they're judged on quarterly results, on, you know, there's a lot of pressure for kind of immediate success. So is part of your role convincing designers or convincing the brands that this show, this way of presenting it, is going to be good in the long term?
I mean, a lot of what it is that to conceive and to produce a fashion shows is our elements that aren't said. They're not a given, but I believe they're our job. We don't need to explain all of it. I think it's our mission. So I tend to have that deep discussion at the beginning of a relationship, but not necessarily every season. Sometimes you propose something that is not so well received or understood, and then you explain, well, yeah, but then you get into theoretical explanations. It's not really frictions. There's a lot of back and forth between myself and my team and the designers when it comes to proposing and creating what would be the show that we'll do together. But there isn't really tensions where you need to justify every one of those things. I mean, in fact, it's an important point to say. I said that the fashion world, and especially the world of fashion shows, has grown tremendously in importance and in budgets and in size. But regardless of that, even though, of course, the world is not the same than it was 25 years ago, the exercise of fashion shows and fashion weeks has become a million times more professional and more regimented and more square and more of that than it was. We're still in a world that, unlike most others of that size, the decision of spending such large amounts, and whether it's a huge house which has big budgets, and the budgets are very, very important, or it's a small house that don't have big budgets, but what they put in the show, it's still very important for them. It's tremendously important. The decisions of what, how to spend this money, how to use these budgets, is done very, in a way, spontaneously by very little amount of people, based mostly on trust and on creativity. And I don't think you can say that of many industries, if you call fashion an industry. I mean, when we spend millions on the show. And the reason I say that, I mean, obviously I see it like we all do, but also I have had the chance to work in other industries. I still dedicate more time and energy to the fashion world than many other industries, but mainly because of that reason, because of the fact that we still can come up with what will prove hopefully later to be incredibly good communication ideas, but spend very important budgets and bring crazy ideas for those budgets to only two or three people and not 20 or 30, like it would be the case in other industries. So what I'm trying to say is that, specifically speaking, in a large house like Dior, for example, whom I've been with for almost 20 years, the relationship and the decision-making of such important decisions and expenditures are basically made by the fashion designer, the head of communication, Olivier, the president, Mr. Toledano, and the owner, Mr. Arnault. And that's it, period. There isn't meetings and meetings and meetings with tens of people like you would have if we were doing the same thing, probably for a car or a technology product or a high-end, sometimes real estate product or a other type of, in fact, industries that have high-end and luxury products that are very similar to what fashion is, that addresses the very same audience, but still don't really realize or accept the fact that creativity alone is what can bring you the furthest with that additional long, slow, inappropriate sometimes marketing studies. Yeah. And that trusting a handful of people, not even a handful, a couple of creative people, amongst which, of course, you have business minds, but still, nevertheless, they give priority in the decision-making on who to give the power to creativity. And that's probably the most important, one of the reasons why I'm still there and I still want to do more and better there, because I think you it's a great chance, a chance that the people within the fashion industry often forget.
I wanted to ask about how fashion shows have changed. As you mentioned, it's become a much bigger industry and more controlled. Obviously, for runways, it's now everything's streamed. Your audience is millions of people rather than just the couple of hundred people in the room. How does that change your role?
I mean, in a way, it changes everything. Not so much the way I think of things, but it changes everything in terms of what the fashion shows. I mean, in fact, part of the answer to that question is the reason why I accepted and decided to publish that book now, with the chance that Phaidon came to me and proposed me and, in fact, followed me with everything I wanted in it. It's been called Fashion Show Revolution because when I started, I think I helped revolutionize the way fashion shows and fashion weeks were over 25 years ago. Now, I think it was time to, in a way, close that chapter and start a new one, because we are definitely in a new fashion show revolution led by the technology and the social media. I mean, I went from shows which were strictly private and professional, as we said at first, to opening up, to turning them into more, being more mediagenic and then TVgenic and then webgenic. They went from private to newspaper to TV to web to the internet. And now they're really, obviously it's been a few years, but it's the technology is going so far that it's now that we see the complete switch. Now they're in the palm of everybody's hand in the world, live on a much smaller screen than back then, which is a bigger, for us, it's a big exercise to succeed in making something looking good in 3 to 5 inches rather than 15 to 30. So we've changed the way we make them look for them to fit in the palm of the hand. We've changed the way they look from everywhere because everyone shoots them from everywhere in the room and not just from the end of the runway, like for the previous 20 years. We've changed the way we cue them so that they could fit first great in a picture from everyone's hands, then in a 15-second video when Instagram started with 15 seconds a few years ago, and now from a slightly longer video because Instagram has it longer, but yet we stay in short momentums because no one's attention span anyway anymore is more than 15 to 30 seconds on a video or anything. We've shortened them tremendously from when I started where they were over 30 minutes to now where they're below 10 minutes. And that we've done already. All of that is the start of that second revolution. What I think will happen now and happen next is that we need to acknowledge the fact that ultimately the most important of audiences is the one that's not necessarily in the room, that's following it up live on their devices. And with the way we're going to use, and we are starting to use technology now by giving an even better access, and it will get better and better. We'll offer 360. We'll offer a BTS behind the scenes. We'll offer zooming capabilities from 360 cams in middle of the runways and rooms where you can zoom into people's faces if you want to on the first row. We'll offer, obviously, a better view than if you were not at the first row, which is the case of many people, of course. So to a certain degree, I think that the revolution is starting where the necessity, sadly or not, of being live at a live fashion show will change a little bit, will evolve to not being so consistent, so permanent, and so repetitive. I think it will open up to more freedom in the format of fashion weeks, in the sense that once it's accepted by the industry, by both sides, the ones who do and the ones who come and watch, by the designers and their houses and by the traditional media, that the equilibrium in which they were for many years, which is the house makes a very important and expensive fashion show for the media to come and see it so that they can then report it. The truth is they're both spending a lot of money for the other, and the equation comes to zero. Because the reality of today is that the biggest media is the social media, that the biggest, the most important viewers are online, live, everywhere else, and that even the media itself could see as well, if not better sometimes, without even necessarily being there. Fashion shows won't die. I'm convinced of that in the sense that a luxury brand, to remain a luxury brand and separate itself from the non-luxury brand, needs to continue to make its audience dream. And a big part of what creates that dream is those exclusive live events that you can see in the palm of your hand, but not necessarily be at. However, whether they're obliged to happen in those four cities on those exact weeks for these exact people, that will change. That I am convinced will change. And maybe for communication, creative and artistic reasons, for the sustainability of the luxury brands, they'll start, which we started with some brands, moving around a little more, to be a little more surprising, to be a little less repetitive, to address new audiences, and to allow themselves new artistic solutions by going to other places at other times in even maybe different formats. In other words, the live event and the live fashion show could happen to me anywhere, at any time, in any place, as long as it's intelligently reported.
The Big Interview is produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin, and I'm Jamie Waters. Thank you very much for listening.